You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello, and welcome to episode 42 of Tea Break Archaeology. I am your host, Dr. Matilda Siebrecht, and today I am savouring a Christmas tea, because you know what? It's December, and I'm allowed to. I love having Christmassy things, and I've been so busy with work that I kind of forgot that Christmas is coming up. And even though I admit I am not necessarily religious, which is kind of relevant in the discussion of today's episode, I have nothing against religion, just personally do not subscribe to a religion myself. Nevertheless, the sort of spirit of Christmas is always something that's really gripped me. So I enjoy having sort of spiced fruits and cinnamony things and just kind of embracing that cozy feel that comes around Christmas time. So that is why I'm having a Christmas tea. It is December, so I feel like I'm allowed to have it at this point. But yes, it's very nice. It's cinnamony and fruity and all sorts of delicious things. I hope that everyone is having a wonderful end to the year. This will be the last episode of Tea Break Archaeology for this year that is recorded. I do have two very special treats coming up over the holiday period, which are actually pre-recorded episodes that were recorded last year, even when we had our APN 10 celebration to celebrate 10 years of the Archaeology Podcast Network. And we had a wonderful day of live events from all of our different shows. And I featured a very fun Tea Break 20 Questions episode featuring special guests Emma Jones and Raven Todd De Silva. And luckily for you, I pre-recorded those. They were only available to APN members for a long time. But now, because it has been a year, we've decided to open it up to everyone. So lucky you, you get to listen to them. So that's something to look forward to over the holiday period. And then I'll be back again in the new year with a little fresh topic. Now that we have finished with the topic of notebooks and bookbinding and fun manuscripty things, we're going to be looking at something a bit different in the new year. So watch out for that. But in today's tea break, we're going to be doing something a little bit different. We're going to dive way back in history, and we're going to look a little bit at the history of tools. And by that, a really, really deep dive. So those of you who are familiar with this podcast will already know I am a material culture specialist. That means that I specialize in looking at material culture, aka the material remains, the physical remains of past cultures. So basically, I love things, and which you've probably gathered through listening to this podcast, because it features things as the base. I'm not really sure why. I think the reason, I just have always been a fan of things, which is terrible. My house is completely full of stuff. And yeah, I feel like it's sort of an innately human trait. I know that there's a lot of people who enjoy minimalism, who enjoy simplicity. I am not one of those people. But anyway, so today we're going to be embracing my love of things and also embracing my love of deep human history. And by that, I really mean like ancient hominin history. So at the moment, I happen to be teaching a course at the University of Groningen on human evolution, which I am loving. I have a great class. And yeah, it's been really fun to dive back into what actually originally got me into archaeology, which was human evolution and the Paleolithic. So sort of the really early Stone Ages. And so, yeah, it's been really fun to dive back into that topic and to sort of experience that all again, remind me of my teenage years or my even younger years when I was just slightly obsessed with primates. I'm not sure why, just I was obsessed with primates. I wanted to be a primatologist. And then at some point at university, I was also really always interested in human evolution. And then when I was at university, I wasn't studying archaeology when I first went to uni, actually. I was studying film, of all things. But I had a friend who was studying archaeology. We were in an anthropology class together. So she was studying also archaeology as well as anthropology. And I decided to join her for one of her lectures because we were meeting for lunch anyway. And I thought, I'll join you beforehand for one of your lectures. And we went in and it was all about human evolution. And I was hooked, absolutely hooked. I changed my major to archaeology that week and caught up on all of the courses I'd missed in the second semester. So I had to do kind of double courses. And yeah, that was how my career in archaeology started. So human evolution and that kind of topic has always been a really deep love of mine. Material culture and kind of a love of things has always been deep-seated, but the actual sort of archaeological study of material culture in my career came a bit later, but actually also already in my undergraduate degree. So in the first 4 years of university for me, I remember doing a paper about a Viking twisted silver bracelet. And I loved looking up about the research reports. I loved reading up about the artifact types. I loved all of the scientific analysis of it. So yeah, so today we're going to be combining two of my great loves. We're going to be combining things, and we're going to be combining ancient hominins and human evolution. And we're going to look at how the first kind of tools came about, the history of tools. Now, I'm not going to go into detail about like later prehistory, because then it gets very complex very quickly. And we quite frankly don't have that much time. So today we're mainly going to be looking at really ancient human history, which was actually also really fascinating for me, because although, like I said, when I was younger, I was really interested in human evolution, at that point, I wasn't yet interested in the material culture side of things. I was more interested in the primatology side of things. So I was looking at them from a biological perspective. But now going back, it's really interesting to focus on the materials and focus on the tools. So first of all, let's have a little think about tool use, because tool use is one of those things that everyone sort of, when we're talking about, okay, but what actually makes us human? What differentiates us from the beasts, you know, which, I mean, has all sorts of problematic implications anyway. But one of the main things that's discussed alongside various other concepts is the fact that we use tools. There are other animals that use tools. There are even non-primates that use tools. One of the most famous examples is crows, of course, who are very good at problem solving. They use things like pebbles to make water levels rise in order to get to treats that are in cups. They use long sticks to kind of poke into things and get access to stuff. So they're one of the sort of most intelligent creatures that use tools in that way. There's all sorts of other examples of animals using tools. Of course, the most famous are primates, indeed. So probably one of the most famous examples are chimpanzees, who have likely been using tools for a very long time. But actually, it was the late, great Jane Goodall, who, of course, passed away recently. And it was her who first noticed in 1960 that chimpanzees were actually using tools, but purposefully using them. So, for example, they were using sticks to poke into holes in termite mounds to get out the termites and ants and things like that. They were using heavy sticks and rocks to crack open fruit. And what was interesting is that they were doing it, and you could see the younger chimpanzees learning from their parents, watching their parents, practicing it themselves to limiting, of course, efficiency. But so you could also see kind of this tradition, this technological tradition being passed down through the generations, which is really fascinating, because this was something that we thought only humans had at this point. So not just kind of, oh, what can I use to help me problem solve right now? Okay, I'll use this. But actually learning a particular technique, this tool is definitely used for this. Learning that from your parents, passing it down to the next generation, that was something we thought was purely human. But actually, chimpanzees do that as well. And then another really interesting example of primate tool use are capuchin monkeys. White-faced capuchins, to be specific, were sort of first noticed in around 2004 that they were also using rocks to pound nuts and fruit. And it's particularly cute when you see a capuchin monkey do it. I don't know. I'm going to put a link to some videos in the show notes, because it's absolutely adorable. They sort of lift it up with their full body weight and pound it into the rock surface. And not only do we know that they do this, but there were some really fascinating papers that came out a couple of years ago. There were excavations in 2019 in Serra da Capibara National Park in Brazil, where a particular site suggests that this activity, so using rocks to pound these tools by capuchin monkeys, might have been happening here for 3,000 years. So not only do capuchin monkeys use tools in this way, but they have been doing so for 3,000 years. They have a prehistory, which is fascinating to me. And I love that idea. So, point being, we are not unique in tool use in that respect. But when did we first start using tools, and how did that actually come about? So in terms of primates and chimpanzees, for example, our sort of divergent ancestor that separates us from the chimpanzee line happened around 6 million years ago. And from that point, we kind of went our separate ways in terms of evolutionary development. So a lot has happened since then. At that point, at least we have not found any evidence that we were using tools. Maybe we were, but the problem is, of course, preservation is an issue, right? I mean, there's a reason that we haven't got actually that many fossils from the really ancient early sort of hominin species. There's a limited amount compared to later periods. I mean, if you think of like the medieval period where you're sort of tripping over graves as an archaeologist, trying to find a complete skeleton of, you know, Ardipithecus ramidus is very difficult. So yeah, there's all sorts of issues in preservation the further back in time you go, because of course, the longer that something is buried in the ground, the more likely that sort of taphonomic processes, aka things that happen to it in the ground. So that might be weathering, that might be being gnawed on by animals. There's so many examples of sites being completely disturbed through rabbits building their warren in the middle of it. So then they burrow around and they move things around and all of that kind of stuff, through things like climate change, through all kinds of stuff, through the soil conditions, environmental conditions, all sorts of things. These taphonomic processes can affect how well an object is preserved in the ground. Now, most of the time we have issues, of course, with organic artifacts. And I think I've talked about that previously on the podcast, because organic artifacts, aka things like wood, leather, paper, etc., those, of course, don't preserve as well in the ground. I mean, if you think about it, if you would bury a piece of wood or a piece of leather or a piece of paper or anything like that, piece of bone in the ground, usually after a while, it's more likely to decay than something like stone, right? Stone will not decay. Stone might crumble, it might burn, but it won't kind of become one with the soil again, unless it's really a really, yeah, specific process that's undertaken. But that means that stone tools are one of the most prevalent tool types in the archaeological record, aka the most often ones that we find in the ground are stone tools. So that's what we use when we're trying to look at ancient technologies. Those are the ones that survive most often. Maybe they were using things like antler, maybe they were using things like wood, but those tools just haven't survived in the ground, so we don't know what they would have used. But what we do know is that they were using particular kinds of tools. And the way that we classify those tools are known as, well, there's sort of different systems that you can use. So you can say it's a technological tradition. And by tradition, I don't mean like, you know, oh, traditionally. I mean, a tradition is in this case sort of a particular form of technology kind of thing. And by technology, I mean a tool, a stone technology. Another word that's often used is industry. So you have the older one industry, Acheulean industry. You also have things like techno-complex. There's all kinds of definition words used. Archaeologists love to use definitions. We love to put things in categories. So I like the phrase technological tradition personally, so I'm going to keep using that one. So that basically means you're looking at what kinds of techniques were people using to create their stone tools? What kinds of artifacts were they making from their stone tools? How did they use them? And there's a couple of different sort of subcategories. So there's different classifications of different types of industries or traditions or techno-complexes, which we're going to get into in a minute. But there's also another way to distinguish it, which is known as the mode system. And this was created by Graham Clark back in 1969. And it was basically an attempt to classify stone tools by their complexity. Because at that point, you had the sort of deep history or history set into three categories, which was Stone Age, Bronze Age, Iron Age. And this was something that was put in place by Thompson. It's very famous categories. But Stone Age encompasses hundreds of thousands of years. So they wanted some way to kind of subcategorize that as well. And one way that they thought of doing that, or that Graham Clark thought of doing that, was by looking at classifying stone tool technologies by their complexity. So basically, how were people making these tools? Let's classify them in those different ways. So that's what we're going to get into. So you had modes 1 to 5, and basically each one kind of increased in complexity the further up you went. Interestingly enough, you actually have a new mode system, which is proposed by John Shear in more recent years, which actually includes 9 different modes. And that really focuses on the chain opératoire of the tools. By chain opératoire, that's a fancy French terminology that is quite often used in archaeology, especially in material culture studies. And it basically means the chain of operations, chain opératoire, right? So it basically means the different steps that you take in order to create something. So for example, creating a cup of tea. First, you need to take the kettle, and fill it with water. Then you need to boil that water. Then you need to get tea. You need to apply the boiled water onto the tea. You need to let it steep for a moment. Sometimes you might add milk. Sometimes you might do this. When you finish with the tea, you will dispose of the tea in some way. You may need other tools. You may need a spoon. You will definitely need a cup. You will need all these things. So sometimes it's very complex. Sometimes you need all sorts of other tools. Sometimes you have other technologies coming in. Sometimes it's very simple. And stone tools is actually a relatively, even though it is complex and it is complicated, it's actually a relatively easy one to define in terms of its chaîne opératoire, because you're, especially for the earlier modes, because you're just working with the stone a lot of the time. And then later on, as you get into the further modes, you have this thing called composite tools, which is basically when you use glue and you stick things onto handles. So then it gets a little bit more complicated. But what actually are all of these different modes? Well, mode one, you have this thing called pebble tool industries. Mode two is known as bifacially worked tools, aka it's been worked on both sides. Mode three is something called prepared core tools, which is something really fascinating. And I'm going to explain all of these in a lot more detail in a second. Mode four is the production of long blades, which are then often retouched into sort of scrapers and murines, etc. And then mode five is microlith technology. So really tiny blades, which are very cute. So we're going to discuss those in a little bit more detail. But first, I think I need to top up my tea. All that discussion of chaîne opératoire has made me thirsty. I'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I have done my refill of my Christmas tea and I'm feeling all sorts of lovely spicy things in the teacup. So let's go way back and see what the earliest evidence of technology, of stone tools is that we have. So actually, we're going to go a very long way back. We're going to go back to around 3.3 million years ago. And this is the first example of mode one stone technology, which is known as pebble tool industries. And this is a very simple type of tool. Basically, you have very large bits of stone, you hammer them with other bits of stone, and from that, you can create sharp edges which you use to cut things. And so it's quite difficult to identify these kinds of tools because they're not sort of as beautifully shaped as the stone tools that you might be thinking of that you've seen from later prehistoric periods, like the Neolithic, where they have really complicated and beautifully created daggers. I will put a link in to a really gorgeous Danish dagger that is absolutely gorgeous. So, but this earliest technology, known as Lamequian, because it was discovered in Lamequia. So what's really fascinating about these earlier tools, the Lamequian technology, so this really simple, quite crudely created tools, one might say, very simply created tools, I guess, is that they actually predate Homo as a genus. So by Homo, I mean, you know, Homo sapiens, Homo neanderthalensis, Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, the sort of later part of the human evolutionary tree. This came before that. So actually, Lamequian tools are most likely associated with two previous species called Kenyanthropos or even the Australopithecus. You may know Australopithecus afarensis, which is Lucy, which is a very famous skeleton that was discovered, a fossilized skeleton that was discovered. So yeah, so these come a long time. I mean, remember, 3.3 million years ago. So that's a long time ago. And then you start to see some kind of, so that's sort of the earliest form. And then you start to see something which is a little bit more complex, but it's still pretty rudimentary in terms of design. And there's sort of three main categories of tool type. So you have the kind of what's known as a core, which is sort of almost like a chopper, basically, like a really rough, big, thick axe. You do have things known as flakes. Flakes are kind of the bits that chip off the main core. And they're usually almost kind of like a knife that they're sort of used for. You can also use them as scrapers, so to kind of scrape skin off and those kinds of things. And then, of course, you need hammer stones, because in later periods, you start to see antlers being used. But in these earlier periods, we don't think that they're processing the antlers in this way. Or if they do, like I say, they don't preserve in the archaeological record, so we don't have them. So you need a hammer stone, because you need a hammer stone to be able to whack at these main stones and chip bits off to use as flakes and create them into a chopper. So this is around 3.3 million years ago, and then it starts to develop. And around sort of 2.6 million years ago, you have a new kind of tradition emerging, which is known as the Olderwandle tradition. And many of you may have heard of this. It's one of the most famous. It was first discovered in Olduvai Gorge. That's where the name comes from. And the first tools were discovered there by Lewis Leakey and his team in the 1930s. And if you're familiar at all with human evolution, then you will be very aware of the name Leakey. The Leakey family were huge in terms of discoveries that really led to broaden our understanding of human evolution. And one of the examples of that is the discovery of these kinds of tools. They've since been found at all sorts of other sites around the world. Not around the world, sorry, in Africa, because that's where we were at this point. And yeah, what's really interesting is they're then associated more with the Homo species, so specifically with Homo habilis, Homo erectus. They're thought to have existed around between sort of 2.6 and 1.7 million years ago, this particular industry type. That's its sort of general date. And even though you do still have, it's still the mode one. It's still that kind of pebble tool industry. But it is a little bit more complex. You start to see a little bit more planning coming in. So it could also, interestingly enough, have been used by earlier hominin species, for example, Paranthropus species, which is another genus, which was kind of like our distant cousin. So we are not descended from them. They're a side branch that died out at some point. And what's really fascinating about this particular technology is that you start to see a little bit more planning and a little bit more intentional raw material selection. So they were picking specific kinds of rocks and specific kinds of stones to make these tools from. There's still a lot of debate over whether these tools are kind of just opportunistic smashing, because actually you can see, for example, when capuchin monkeys are smashing these big rocks onto, you know, other rock beds, flakes do automatically come off, and they are quite similar visually to things like Olderwand flakes. So there's a lot of discussion over whether they are actually intentionally created. But the amount of finds that have been discovered at this point, it's generally assumed that they are. They're the first sort of proper tool technologies that we can see. And what's also really interesting is that you have a lot of sites that have Olderwand technology also in association with things like broken animal bones or bones with butchery marks. And you can tell when something has butchery marks as opposed to other kinds of marks due to microwave analysis. So if you look at it at a small enough level, you can differentiate between kind of naturally created cut marks and trampling marks and those kinds of things and intentional cut marks. So between kind of 1.8 and 1.6 million years ago, you had species such as Homo ergaster that were using this Olderwand technology. But around 1.6 million years ago, you start to see this new tool tradition emerging in Africa. And it's known as the Acheulean tradition. And what's really fascinating is that this really shows intentional tool production and creation. And it becomes the dominant form of technology, I would say, until around kind of 600,000 years ago. So it's the longest lasting tool technique that's ever been utilized by humans. And what's really interesting is that it's still the kind of techniques that are used for it were still being used until kind of later periods in prehistory as well. So it's most often associated with indeed Homo ergaster or Homo erectus, depending on which naming convention you're following. Also later by Homo heidelbergensis. And it is what's really interesting about the Acheulean industry is whereas before you just basically had pebbles. So it was mode one, right? You had pebbles that were being whacked with stones, hammer stones, to create kind of sharpened edges. Acheulean is then mode two in the mode system, bifacially worked tools. And what that means is that you're working them on both sides of the tool to create this beautiful, almost kind of teardrop-shaped tools that are kind of convex on the two sides. And they look beautiful. They're what we typically associate with flint tools, that kind of shape. And it's been worked on both sides, so it has a sharp edge coming from both sides, which is really fascinating. What's also really interesting is that you don't actually see Acheulean technology in Europe until between around kind of 500 and 800,000 years ago. So it was in Africa for a lot longer before it kind of progressed into Europe. And this is particularly interesting when we're looking at something like human cognition, because whereas before you could argue that the mode one stone technologies are kind of people just happening to hit something in kind of the right place and it's sort of lucky, although I would argue that it was around for so long and we find examples from over such a long period that there was nothing lucky about it. But anyway, with this one, there was no luck. This was clearly planned out. And anyone who has ever tried flint knapping will know it's extremely difficult to plan a flint tool. So basically what you're trying to do is you have your piece of flint and you hit it along one edge. And what that does is that it sort of sends like a shock wave from that edge down into the piece of flint and along. And that sort of shock wave from the hit chips off a whole flake, so a whole kind of section of the tool. But that means you need to know where to hit it. You need to know how hard to hit it. You need to know at which angle to hit it. You need to know how to prepare the platform that you're hitting, like the part of the tool that you're hitting, in order to make sure that you don't get too big a flake or too small a flake. And then in order to be able to do that from both sides, that means that you have to be able to plan when to turn things, how to turn things, what kind of material you need, what kind of rough shape you need. And it looks very different at the end to the raw material at the beginning. I personally am very bad at flint knapping. I love it, but I'm very bad at it because I'm rubbish at planning in that way. So that's the Acheulean industry, which is the mode two. And we see that coming in all sorts of different places around the world. So from Africa all the way to China and up into Northern Europe. And it really shows this kind of further developed cognition. And from that, because we can see it happening over, you know, between around 1.6 million years ago to around 300,000 years ago, that's a very long period. And that shows that it was clearly then being passed on down generations, right? So you have that kind of learning or even teaching kind of culture already emerging, which is really fascinating when we're looking at human evolution and we're trying to look at when we became human, when we started to have what we would think of as modern human cognition. How that all came about, looking at these technologies can give us a bit of a clue to that. And that sort of leads on then to mode three kind of tools. And what's really fascinating with them is that they start to emerge with the Homo neanderthalensis, actually, is one of the most kind of associated with the earliest forms of this, rather than us, which I find really fascinating. They're known as, for example, the Mousterian tradition, or the Mousterian industry. And this is a mode three. Mode three, just to remind you, are prepared core tools. Now, what is a prepared core? So a prepared core is basically a massive chunk of flint that you have prepared in a certain way. It's a certain shape that basically then all you need to do is just hit gently around the edge of the core and it'll just create all these beautiful blades. So when you hit it, a beautiful blade will be formed. You can hit again, another beautiful blade will be formed. You have to kind of keep working it and keep sort of making sure that it's the right shape. I'll put a video in the show notes from the wonderful Dr. James Dilley of Ancient Craft UK, who has been on the podcast before talking about flint axes. He is an expert flint knapper. And he has some really great videos on YouTube, which demonstrate this idea of like creating a core and then using that core to create blades. But like, if you think that the bifacially worked tools required pre-planning and like complex cognition, that is nothing to trying to create a prepared core, because that's like 20 steps ahead of where you need to be. And so that's really fascinating, because that is more often, the earliest evidence that we have of this is more often associated with Neanderthals, actually, than with humans. It's known as, it's known as the Mousterian tradition after the French site Le Moustier, which is where the sort of examples were first discovered. And these specific kinds of tools, Mousterian tools, are associated only with Neanderthals. And so, like I said, they're prepared using this technique, which is known as Levallois. It's a very famous technique. And that is used in a lot of different industries. So Mousterian is the sort of technological tradition, is the industry. Levallois is the particular technique that is used. And that's used in all kinds of other industries as well. So yeah, it requires a really incredible amount of forethought and skill, which just, when this was sort of first being discovered, that already was then starting to change our impression of Neanderthals as these kind of brutish, hulking figures with very limited cognition. Because if they're able to create these stone tools that require this incredible amount of complex thinking, this incredible amount of planning and preparation, then what does that say about the rest of their kind of social life and the rest of their culture as well? So that's the kind of Mousterian industry. And that's from around 160,000 to 40,000 years ago. So it's very much associated with the Neanderthals. And we also start at this point to see the emergence of what's known as composite tools. So where you have, there was actually a really fascinating study, which was conducted by some of my colleagues at Leiden University in the Netherlands, where they were looking at glue, at adhesive. And they worked out that actually, in order to create the glue, it was an also extremely complex process, and a really extremely complex recipe was used. You had to do it in exactly the right way. You had to apply it in a particular way. And these kinds of resins were associated with tools that were then associated with Neanderthal sites. So again, that shows that actually Neanderthals, extremely complex thinkers, able to have extremely complex, complex thoughts and think through things, problem solve, in much the same way that we always used to think was just us, was just modern humans, you know? So that's where we start to see that. And then the further on you go, of course, when you get more into the sort of late Stone Age and upper Paleolithic, so from sort of 50,000 years ago onwards, that's when their modes 4 and 5 come into play. So you start to see the emergence of these really long blades, and then also later on, these little micro blades. And that's very much blade-based industries. So you have a lot of tools that are actually created with tiny little blades, microblades or microliths. So for example, the sickle, which you might use to cut down your crops. If you are a Neolithic farmer, you'll have one big thing of bone or wood, and then you'll have lots of tiny little microliths that you'll put in almost to create like a serrated edge, or a serrated sharp edge along this wing. So you see a lot of, you see suddenly like an amazingly quick development in tool complexity within this time. This is really when stone tools completely take off. Either that, or maybe it's just because we happen to have found a lot more of them at this point. Because that's what's really interesting, and that's what I find really fascinating, as I mentioned, about looking into really deep history and looking into the material culture of kind of early Paleolithic history and really ancient history, ancient prehistory, I should say, is that, I mean, one of the things that I keep saying in the course that I'm teaching at the moment is absence of evidence does not mean evidence of absence. So just because we haven't found something doesn't mean that it wasn't there and it wasn't around. Of course, this doesn't mean that you can just claim that something was there that maybe wasn't. But the point is that you can never sort of stop looking, and you can never assume that just because you only find sort of the simple things in the past means that's all they were as well in that case. Anyway, I hope that you enjoyed this little foray into the origins of tools, the origins of objects, and our love of things. A little bit different to my usual, and I know it was a little bit rambling, but hopefully it made sense. But I hope that you enjoyed it. If you're interested in learning more about kind of the early human evolutionary development and sort of ancient hominins, do let me know. I'd love to delve more into this topic. So it would be really interesting to, if it's of interest to other people, then I'd be very happy to find more topics and maybe chat to some experts about it as well. So as I mentioned before, we're going to be having a couple of alternative episodes for the next two episodes, which were pre-recorded back in November, December last year for the APN 10-year anniversary celebrations. But I hope you enjoy them, and I will be back in January with some New Year's resolutions that relate slightly to the topic of the episode. Anyway, looking forward to seeing you then. In the meantime, have a great break, and I'll see you in the new year. Bye.
Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.